Good afternoon. I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order. Today is, I think, March 1st, and I just want to start by apologizing to all the people we didn't get to. As folks know, we had hundreds of people here in multiple rooms watching on TVs on Wednesday. We took testimony from this time we started, which was at 7 until midnight when we were forced to adjourn under House rules. And we got through, we think, 104 people. So we feel that, you know, that was pretty remarkable. Wow. And we appreciate it so much that both sides of the aisle were extremely respectful and civil, and the audience was, I think, really engaged, and we all learned a lot. And I think it was a great hearing, and I'm so thankful for all of our staff on both sides of the aisle and the nonpartisan staff who really worked hard to make that hearing a success. And we want to continue now. We think, to the best of our knowledge, there were about 92 people who did not get heard. And again, we want to apologize. Quite a few of them have submitted written testimony rather than come today. And I want to repeat what I said before, which is all the written testimony is going to be made available when staff has time to accumulate it all. It's come to different members, different staff in both email form and people handing us paper. And so we are going to get that all available to everyone. So again, for the third time, I really want to apologize to all the people we didn't get to. I think 2 minutes at 104 people was pretty successful. We're just going to do what we were doing, which is continue right down the list as we were trying to. And we recognize we're going to be calling people who aren't here. But we want to make sure that we're at least getting everyone's name asked. And I guess, you know, when we, some of these folks have submitted written testimony and others have, you know, like I said, a lot of people have been asked to be taken off the list and I guess didn't want to come back this afternoon. So with that, we're going to get started, and I think we finished on an anti. So we'll go to the pro side, and the some of the names I have on the pro side, I may have them kind of out of order here, I apologize. Jeff Van Wyken, Patricia Nauman, Myra Miles, Rebecca Covington, Rebecca Quentin, this is actually two names, they talked to us, Rebecca Quentin Irie, Councilmember Betsy Hodges, Gary Carlson, Denise Mayotte. If any of those people are here, and then I'll read some of the first antis. Lance Klatt, Ted Brosson, Christian Erickson, Mike Hickey, Amy Langer, Salo, Brian Malm, Scott Gordon, Katie Tagramadjan, Isthus Engineering, I don't have a last name, Derek Madsen, Stephanie Choss. So if any of those people are here, please come forward. And you know what we might want to do, if this is us, is just have people queue up and you just tell us who you are. That's maybe the better thing. So yes, Mr. Van Wyken, please start. But I think rather than reading all 92 names, maybe that's the better approach, because I can see you're not all here. So why don't we do it that way instead? You just tell us who you are, and we'll just go pro-con. So how's that? Mr. Van Wyken, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for making time for another meeting so that all of us can be heard. My name is Jeff Van Wyken. I'm the Director of Tax Policy and Analysis for Minnesota 2020. Today I would like to examine the revenue side of the Dayton budget using two different approaches, beginning with the price of government. As you know, the price of government measures total state and local government owned source revenue as a percentage of statewide personal income. The Coalition of Minnesota Businesses has called the price of government, quote, an index of what taxpayers can afford. This index will decline under the Dayton budget based on projections from Minnesota Management and Budget. Over the last 4 years, Minnesota has had an average price of government of 15.7%. Over the next 4 years, under the governor's budget, it's projected to drop to 15.5%. This is slightly less than the average during the Pawlenty years and significantly less during the average of the 1990s. Another way of evaluating the size of the Dayton budget is an inflation-adjusted dollars per capita. Under the Dayton budget, real per capita general fund revenue is projected to increase by 7% over the next 4 years. However, these revenue increases need to be measured relative to the point we're starting from. During the current biennium, real per capita general fund revenue is over 12% less than it was at the beginning of the century. Furthermore, excluding the biennia since the Great Recession, real per capita general fund revenue will still be at its lowest point since the 94-95 biennia, even after the governor's proposed tax increases. And keep in mind that over the last two decades, we've shifted significant new funding responsibilities into the general fund that were not there in 1994-95, such as general education. Madam Chair, over the last decade, we've seen double-digit declines in real per pupil state aid, increasing class sizes, cuts in funding for higher education, coupled with rising tuition, deteriorating infrastructure, and soaring property taxes. The governor's budget makes progress towards reversing these trends without increasing the index of what taxpayers can afford. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wyken. Appreciate you being here. Welcome. Again, apologies for people who waited through the last hearing. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Rebecca Covington, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, and I'm sitting before you today to express our support for the Governor's revenue proposal. The Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities is a broad-based coalition of more than 100 organizations representing persons with disabilities, providers, and advocates dedicated to improving the lives of people with disabilities. The disability community has weathered cuts biennium after biennium, especially to the Health and Human Services budget, resulting in funding decreases in services and programs that work to support and maintain the health and independence of individuals with disabilities. Individuals within the disability community are often those most at risk during challenging budget times, and many simply cannot pursue an education, employment, or meaningful community participation without the assistance of social supports provided through state funding. The unique nature of our coalition allows us to bring to the table leaders of agencies and organizations that provide services to the disability community, direct support staff professionals, and the clients who receive services and supports. This, in turn, gives us the opportunity to gain a comprehensive view of how budget decisions impact the quality and availability of necessary care to individuals with disabilities. For example, due to budget decisions made last biennium, we are facing an impending 1.67% reduction of funding for disability services scheduled to last from July 1st to December 31st, 2013, and would reduce supports by $12 to $16 million. As responsible partners working towards a balanced budget, we continue to pursue cost-effective, innovative, quality programs and services for the disability community, and we know that we cannot support individuals with disabilities by continuing to cut our way to a balanced budget and without raising revenue to address our fiscal challenges. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Covington. Welcome, Mr. Newstead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your time today. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Newstead. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. The Retailers Association represents 1,500 retail locations of various sizes and industries across Minnesota. In addition, we represent the 482,000 retail jobs, about one in five Minnesota jobs. While we have several areas of concern with the governor's budget proposal, I wanted to take a moment to recognize the importance of the inclusion of the affiliate nexus or Main Street tax fairness language. This provision provides a level playing field for Minnesota's brick-and-mortar retailers, retailers that provide property taxes, payroll, and philanthropy in our communities. We've heard over and over from retailers that they're happy to compete in-store and online, but just want to do it on a level playing field and not have a disadvantage because they choose to have a physical location and presence in Minnesota. Now, one area of concern in this bill is the expansion of the sales tax on clothing. On Wednesday evening, the Shopping Center Association did a good job articulating the behavioral impacts of a clothing tax. I want to emphasize just a couple other possible impacts. First, the expansion will harm Minnesota's retail competitiveness. An absence of tax on most clothing is one of few one of the few advantages for a Minnesota clothing retailer here. This issue is further compounded in border communities. Second, we do ask that the legislature not take away our shopping destination reputation here in Minnesota. From Main Street retailers to regional shopping destinations to the Mall of America, Minnesota truly is tourism relative to sales of clothing in the state. No clothing tax is a strong and powerful marketing message. It's certainly not as, it's no clothing tax on everything under $100. $100 is certainly not as strong of a marketing message. Other areas of concern are the tax on retail services and increased excise taxes on tobacco. And finally, I just wanted to express some opposition to business services tax in the area of advertising in particular. Thank you for the time this afternoon, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Newstead. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. committee members. My name is Thomas Clint. I'm an attorney. I am an owner and president of two Social Security disability companies here in the Twin Cities. We currently employ over 220 people. I was here on Wednesday night, and there's certainly lots of great things that this budget provides for, but there's also certain challenges. I'm here today to express to you the challenge that we have if the sales tax is extended to legal fees or professional services for representing people to get Social Security disability benefits. Our fees are regulated by federal statute. Our fees are paid directly from the federal government. The statute does not allow for withholding of additional fees for sales tax. As such, if we were to have to pay those sales taxes, it would come out of our fees. We do not have the opportunity to collect that sales tax from our clients. Also, we represent many claimants throughout the United States. For us to remain competitive, we would not be able to do so simply because if the client was forced to pay those sales tax, they would simply go to a different firm. This challenge is really a challenge. As an owner, we can solve it by simply going to a different state. I'm here really as concerned about my 220 employees. They're very compassionate in what they do. They assist these people, getting them off the streets, getting them the benefits they deserve. If we're forced to leave, it's my employees that will suffer. I would ask that when you consider the legislation, that you not impose a tax for professional services or legal fees, or at a minimum, make an exception for fees incurred in representing disabled people and getting them the benefits they deserve. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Clint. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Gloria Stock Mickelson, and I work for Travel Leaders in Plymouth. But more importantly, I serve as the president of the Upper Midwest chapter of the American Society of Travel Agents. And as everyone does, I think we understand the need to modernize Minnesota's tax system. But as this bill is currently written, it will have a very serious impact on travel agencies in Minnesota. We have 281 small businesses in Minnesota. We employ about 2,500 people and partner with over 800 independent contractors in this state. We're in large and small cities throughout. Granite Falls, Moorhead, Hibbing, Winona, Rochester, Owatonna, just to name a few, and of course Minneapolis and St. Paul. We survived 9/11 when people were not willing to get on airplanes. During the economic downturn, discretionary dollars went towards necessities rather than a vacation. Business travelers went towards a web conference instead of taking a business trip. We've survived that. Online providers came into the market, and our travel agencies had to reinvent themselves to continue to show value to travelers. But we will not survive a 5.5% sales tax on our gross receipts. You're proposing that a $5,000 vacation trip would now cost $5,275. I don't think very many people in this room will buy it from us. There are too many alternatives for buying your travel. If we absorb it, 50% of our gross income of a travel agency, half of our revenue, will be going towards the sales tax. A travel agency's gross receipts are flow-through funds. We're paying cruise lines, tour operators, and airlines. Federal tax allows us to deduct those flow-through funds when we report our income. This bill is not taking that into consideration. One of our agencies computed their dollars from last Friday. One day paying the sales tax, they would be minus $250. Minnesota travel agencies will not survive, and we hope it won't be the state that will put us under.
Thank you, and thank you for coming back, Ms. Mickelson. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me here to speak today, and thank you for serving on this our community by serving on this committee. My name is Mark Halla, and I have a small business called the Mustard Seed Landscaping and Garden Center. As I listened the other night, I noted you often asked which side someone was representing when they came up to speak. You said this side or that side, and I just have to pose the question, aren't we all on the same side? We all recognize that a problem exists that needs to be fixed. We just have different solutions, some of which will have unintended drastic consequences. With that said, I oppose the business-to-business services tax. Now, 8 years ago, my wife and I started our small business in the basement of our home. Since that time, God has abundantly blessed us, and we now have a flourishing landscaping and garden center, which supports a staff of approximately 15 seasonal employees and between 6 and 8 year-round. Just this winter, we acquired another business, and we anticipate adding about 35 to 40 new employees this spring. God is good, isn't he? Well, I'm here to share some real numbers about a real business to help you inform your decisions. I reviewed our profit and loss reports for the prior 2 years and analyzed how the business-to-business service tax would have impacted us. Though we had sales of just under $1 million each year, sadly, our taxable profit was only $6,600 and $8,000 respectively. You see, we have continued to reinvest nearly everything back into our staff and our company as we grow. The business-to-business services tax, based on our actual P&L, would have resulted in a net loss for our company for each of the last 2 years I reviewed. Now, obviously, we can't absorb that. We would have to lower our expenses and pass on the extra cost to our customers, probably a combination of both. This will slow our growth and impact our employees. Rather than choosing to keep them over the winter in our off-season, we would likely lay many of them off, resulting in unemployment claims the state would bear the burden of. So I'm thrilled to be part of a rapidly growing business. This proposed tax, especially when coupled with the increased health care expenses, which are right around the corner, would be a cumulative burden that I'm not sure our business could bear. The social issues shared with this committee are real, and they do need to be addressed. But without a healthy business environment, Minnesota will be in no position to help those in need. Please don't do anything to harm our businesses. They're indeed the backbone of our economy. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Halla. And I, you know, if people can kind of do for and against, if we can, that was concerns. Do we have a four? No fours? So, come on up. We have two of one side and four of the other. We made sure to alternate them last time, but if we can just try to do it by chair where people kind of figure out, let's call this kind of the pro chair and this kind of the concerns chair. How's that? We'll just go back.
Hold your pen?
So please, yes. Mr.
I'll hold this.
Mr.
My name is
Minnesota. Welcome.
Hi. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am here in support of Governor Dayton's budget, especially increasing early education and special education revenue to provide equal and stable funding for education. My name is Mark Cry, and I work as a special ed paraprofessional at Heritage Eastham Magnet Middle School, and I also work for their before and after school program. My day begins a half hour after the school day has started. I go to science class, check in with the 12 special ed kids that I work with, see which ones are the furthest behind. Then I help them for about 10 minutes. Then we pack up the lab, we have a discussion, then we move on to the next class. I have coworkers that do start at the beginning of the school day, but they leave a half hour early. It wasn't always like this. 10 years ago when I started, we actually had 15 minutes more time than the school day, so we could actually talk with the teachers about the students we had problems with and work out a plan so that they could be successful. Currently, our school day, our work day is a half hour less than the school day is long. The sad part is that the students, they think this is okay. They think this is normal. This is happening throughout the state with school support staff, and this is not right. What caused this failure? Failure to raise revenue the last 10 years has caused this. So now a child's address determines their education. A child's education should not be based by their address. Children are our greatest resource. They are the future of our city, our state, and our country, yet most times they're stuffed into overcrowded classrooms without the staff to adequately service them. And that's why we need to provide better educational funding and raise the revenue to do it. That's why I support Governor Dayton's bill to unlock the kids' future and provide equal and stable funding for our future in Minnesota. I challenge each and every one of you to go spend a day in either Minneapolis or St. Paul inner city school, see what goes on in their classroom, talk with their staff, and see what they need. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cry. I want to remind folks, after you've testified, please sign into the clipboard. You'll all be in the minutes, and some legislators will want to talk to some folks, and so that's how we can reach you. Ms. Brown. Thank you, Mr. Cry. Ms. Brown.
Thank you. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're a 2,000-member statewide organization representing nonprofits in Minnesota. I am in the concerns chair, and I do have a serious concern, but first I'd like to offer significant support for the overall revenue raising that is offered in this proposal, and the way that that both solves the budget deficit and sets Minnesota on a better course for the future, as well as strong support for the reduction of regressivity in this proposal. My concerns are specifically related to the sales tax on the services that nonprofit organizations provide. I'd like to thank the Governor's Office and the Department of Revenue for helping us over the last couple of weeks try to sort out just which services would be taxed and which wouldn't. And they've been extremely helpful. The fact is we serve the community in so many different ways, and there's such a wide array of services, as well as a really wide array of the ways that we put together the funding and the fees for our services, that it's difficult to come up with a very specific black and white list of what would be taxed and what would not be taxed. But I thank them for helping us as we've had to sort that out. Taxing the services, the program memberships, fees, and admissions for nonprofit organizations directly increases the costs on those people for whom the nonprofit organization intends to provide service at the lowest possible cost. Our delivery model is designed to keep costs as low as possible for consumers, and in many cases we leverage resources from philanthropy, from volunteers, from individual donors, in order to offer services either on a sliding fee scale or many, many times at no cost at all. Our services really meet a wide range of individual, family, and community needs. They're often culturally relevant and addressing some of the most pressing and long-standing issues in the community. At both the state and federal levels, nonprofit organizations and the people who contribute to them are given tax exemptions and deductibility, and we think it would be a good policy for Minnesota to also extend exemptions to the people that we serve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name's Valerie Ralstead. I'm a mom, a wife. I've worked as a special ed para for 15 years. I've been involved with my school district, Columbia Heights, since I was a student. I have three children, two that have a learning disability, just like me. I could not read and spell when I was young. I got the help I needed to get into college and become a productive person in the classroom to help students now move forward. I feel that in the past we've had too many politicians paying lip service to our children's education and not investing in their future. When I started as a special ed para, we had over 60 in the unit. Now it's down to about 30. In my building, we have 7, with 2 of them having to service those students in the general population. Students with individual educational plans are not getting the service like they should. There is not enough time in the classroom for one teacher to serve a child. My youngest is a product of this. My child's a senior in high school and still struggles with reading, where my middle child was able to get the help and be off the IEP by high school. They're only 4 years apart. Too much is being taken out of our children's education. We are squandering our children's future. My oldest child wants to be a teacher. She went to college thinking she'd get a job. That's not happening because hard-pressed schools are increasing class sizes since they cannot afford to hire new teachers. Her loans aren't going away, and she struggles each month to meet her bills and works two jobs. We need to start investing in our children, our future. The corporations have had their chance to trickle down to move us forward. I have not seen any money going towards what I value, schools, communities, or higher education. All we've heard is districts having to cut programs, larger classrooms, going to 4-day school weeks. These are not Minnesota values. Now our children are facing more cuts. Dayton's budget addresses these issues by investing $640 million in the education of our children. In order to invest in education, we need to raise revenue. That's why I support the governor's revenue bill. Cutting our state support for education and our children's future will not help our economy. It will only stall the economic engine that our children's education needs. We need fairness, not cutting the dreams of our future children. So I ask you, will you fight to invest in our children's future to continue protecting tax cuts for the corporate rich?
Thank you. Mr. Ralstead. Welcome.
I am Joe Witt, President and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent about 95% of the 420 banks operating in Minnesota, from the biggest to the smallest. We oppose the business-to-business sales tax on services. This type of tax is bad public policy because it will hurt local businesses and Minnesota consumers. To bear the cost of this tax, businesses will either charge their customers more for their products and services or they will shrink. Businesses owe a duty to their owners, employees, and customers to make sure that they are viable. All businesses must account for this type of massive tax increase, and the only way to account for it in the end is for consumers to pay more. Let me give you a banking example, a mortgage loan. Federal and state banking laws require us to work with outside providers to conduct this transaction. We hire an appraiser, we order a credit report, we hire a title attorney, and we hire a closing agent. Each of those providers would now add a sales tax to the cost of their services. While the bank contracts for those services and incurs the sales tax, ultimately the borrowers will bear the costs of those additional sales taxes. We also oppose the new proposed tax on banking and investment services. This latest economic downturn proved the importance of consumers having access to fair financial products and services at a fair price. Many consumers got a mortgage from a fly-by-night finance company that advertised on late-night TV or over the internet. They wished that they had worked with their local bank. They would have liked to sit down face-to-face with a local person who could help them address their issues instead of dealing with an 800 number of a loan servicer that has now gone out of business. Our local banks offer their consumers basic, fair, and straightforward deposit, loan, and investment options because they want to serve all their customers' financial needs for their entire lifetimes. They make sure their customers understand what they are getting, and requiring local banks to collect sales taxes on basic banking products and services while letting all those other providers off the hook is the exact opposite of what we need right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. We appreciate you being here. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Yankuba Fadera. I live in Maplewood, Minnesota, and works at St. John's Hospital as an emergency room technician. I'm here to speak in favor of the governor's tax proposal. I support the governor's tax proposal because I know we need to invest in Minnesota care. Every day, people come to us for cares that aren't really emergency, like diabetes management and blood pressure management and a mere sore throat. These are people who need to be seen in a primary care setting, but they come to us because they cannot afford Minnesota care, or they don't have Minnesota care. The real problem comes when people are seen in emergency room a little too late. Recently, I saw an otherwise healthy 26-year-old who came to us because he woke up early in the morning with a symptom of blindness. A friend of him brought him to us, and after many tests, he was diagnosed with a severe kidney failure that had been developing for several months. With an affordable primary care, he would have been diagnosed much earlier, and the treatment would have been a different case. I support the governor's budget because my co-workers and I agree that, or we know that, investing in healthcare saves lives. Thank you, and wish you all the best.
Thank you, Mr. Fadera. Not sure I got that right, but thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Bruns, and I'm the president of Annandale State Bank, and I'm also this year's current chairman of the Minnesota Bankers Association. Banks are the economic engine that help drive our state's growth and expansion. We are the ones that work closely with our commercial customers, and we hear directly how the Minnesota tax policies impact the state's business leaders. Our current economy is very fragile, with lots of talks about the fiscal cliffs, the debt ceilings, rising health care costs, etc. Business leaders are, in fact, very anxious. The type of huge tax increases that are included in this proposal are the wrong public policy at the worst possible time. Specifically, we oppose the proposed top-tier income tax because of the significant impact it has on Subchapter S and other pass-through taxpayers. Minnesota is home to thousands of small businesses, which are essential to our economy. The vast majority of these businesses are pass-through taxpayers, either as partnerships, single-member LLCs, or Subchapter S corporations. Many of our state's small banks, including my bank, are Subchapter S taxpayers. Rather than paying taxes at the corporate level, the full amount of the Sub-S business earnings are taxed on the owner's personal income taxes. Most of the taxpayers affected by this proposed top-tier income tax are on hard-working small businesses. Business owners are the job providers. They are the ones that take the risks and make sure that Main Street is vibrant. They are the businesses who are the make our cities and towns work. Adding this top-tier income tax will hurt those job providers and serve as a disincentive for economic growth and expansion. While Subchapter S and other pass-through taxpayers do not pay tax at the corporate level, they do operate their businesses in a way that accounts for these taxes. They have to account for payroll taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, and yes, income taxes. They add those taxes to their operating costs, like facilities expenses or their employee salaries and benefits. After they are fully account for all the expenses, they then determine the price for the products and services. Businesses need to operate profitably or they will not be in business. Again, they will account for their tax increases included in this proposal. The bottom line is that these proposed tax increases are significant and will seriously hurt Minnesota businesses and Minnesota consumers.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Burns.
You.
Welcome.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Felder, and I'm a Sunday school at St. James AME Church. And it was brought to our attention during our last district meeting that the education of our children within the inner city schools is failing miserably. And so we decided, you know, what can we do about this? And so I'm put here forth today to say that we recommend the governor's budget and that we would really like to see people in the state taking responsibility for the failure of the education that children have been receiving. And we're glad that this budget was put forth so we can start to change that along the way, because it not only affects their education, but it affects the rest of our future in the long run. When you think about it, we need to make substantial futures for these children so that they can be positive role models in our futures as well. And I just want to say thank you for that, and that I would like for you to take time out also to go into an inner city school and see. It's documented 49 children in an English classroom. How much attention can that teacher really give? Teachers need to be of more plentiful. We need more teachers in the schools. We have a lot of children. There are different things that are going on. These are different times than when we were younger. When we were younger, we were number one in education some years. We were the happiest state. We were the healthiest state. And when you go into the schools and you look at these children, that is not the case anymore. And that is something really serious because, again, it's going to affect all of us in the long run. So I just want to applaud the governor's budget and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Felder. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Paul Cirkbenek. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council, an association of 17 private, nonprofit, four-year liberal arts colleges. Our colleges don't receive any direct state appropriations, but I want to speak for the thousands of college students who benefit from Governor Dayton's proposal to increase funding for the Minnesota State Grant Program. That's a program that provides need-based financial aid to lower income and middle class students, students who attend both public and private institutions, 2 and 4 year schools, full time and part time. As an association of private colleges, we're not tax experts and we recognize how difficult it is to raise taxes at any time. However, we want you to know that the Private College Council supports increased revenues because we believe that increasing state revenues is necessary to bring our state's budget into structural balance and to make strategic investments in education that will build a highly talented, highly competitive workforce for decades to come in the state of Minnesota. As you make difficult choices in putting together the next state budget, we urge you to raise the level of revenue necessary to allow the state to make critically needed investments in higher education and the state grant program in particular. Increased financial aid will help keep college affordable for students, will help students graduate on time, will reduce student debt burdens, and will strengthen Minnesota's economy. But these outcomes can't be achieved without the tax revenues necessary to support increased funding of the state grant program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cirkbenek. So you caught us up because we were kind of uneven. So this is going to be the pro-chair and kind of concerns chair. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Willie Snyder, and I'm on the pro side here. I'm not an accountant, I'm not a banker, not a business owner, I'm not a statistician or a politician. I'm a middle-class human service worker employed by Ramsey County to directly assist persons with developmental disabilities and a massive number of complicating secondary diagnoses. I was prepared to speak before you on Wednesday evening, but I had to go to work. I stay awake at night, keep people in the building that shouldn't be out in their pajamas and bare feet. And I toilet people and clean up after them as anybody who's got a heart would do for somebody that can't clean up after themselves. I appear before you this afternoon having worked last night. And we did have one elopement last night, not in my building, but we did have somebody that ran outside and had to be retrieved. I'm somewhat sleep deprived, but I hope my words retain saliency. The clients I work with do not hold the keys to mansions. It is, in fact, sometimes my job to teach clients to use keys to their own bedrooms. Though I am employed by Ramsey County, my clients have arrived for my care from Iowa, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. Minnesota, where I live and work, cares for persons with disabilities. Ramsey County needs the tax dollars for this care so that persons with severe self-injurious behavior, extreme aggression to others, pervasive property destruction, and unremitting elopement tendencies, and also a head-spinning assortment of other disabilities may be assisted humanely, adequately over the course of their lifetimes. I work for a common good. I work for Ramsey County. I live in and pay taxes in the state of Minnesota. I support Governor Dayton's tax proposal. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. And to you and again to everyone, we so apologize. We couldn't get through everyone, and we realize what an inconvenience this is. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Quentin Irie. I own several companies across multiple industries here in Minnesota and in other states as well. Every business, every person has a breaking point. I grew up in Minnesota with values and beliefs that I still hold true to this day. I love this state. My wife and I are proud parents of seven children who think they're related to Goldie Gopher. The proposed B2B sales tax would cost our clients $1.1 million over 5 years, effectively pricing me out of the market and forcing my clients to outsource either out of state or out of the country. This is not just a penalty to me, but also to the 220 people I currently employ in Minnesota and across the country. In addition, the sales tax will cost my businesses $275,000 on the services they purchase. To add insult to injury, the proposal has a full 21% increase in my personal income tax, all for the privilege of living in Minnesota. My companies are S corporations, which means the profit of the business goes directly to my personal income taxes. Ladies and gentlemen, $1.4 million in additional business tax plus a 21% increase in my personal income tax is more than enough incentive for me to move everything I own out of Minnesota. I've never asked for anything from Minnesota other than to be allowed the freedom to pursue the best future for my family and not be punished for my achievements. I'm here to tell you what others want to hide. There is a quiet exodus from the state of Minnesota. You may not notice this now, but in 5 years, when you're raising taxes yet again, you'll notice the steady decline of numbers of successful small businesses. I was invited to testify here by people who still believe Minnesota has a chance and the will to turn this around. While I respect and admire those people, unfortunately, I do not agree. That's why I'm moving my multiple businesses as well as my family out of the state of Minnesota. This is not hyperbole. It's not a threat. I've already relocated one business that generated $4 million in sales in 2011 out of Minnesota. My remaining businesses will depart inside of 60 days. I purchased a home out of state, and if you're looking for a nice large home near Lake Minnetonka, one's for sale very soon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Irie. I hope I got that right, so thank you. Mr. Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Bruce Nelson, the Chief Executive Officer for the past 17 years of ARM. ARM is an organization of providers who support people in their homes or in group homes with disabilities, people with developmental disabilities, autism, mental illness, physical disabilities, brain injuries. I'd like to give you a quick combination of facts here that I hope will help in your deliberations. Number one, the state faces a $627 million deficit. Number two, our members employ 30,000 caregivers across the state of Minnesota, including some people who are below the poverty level and have to work multiple jobs. They serve and support and care for our most vulnerable citizens. Three, turnover among our members is 40% a year. When you ask parents what's most important, parents of the people served in the services, they say consistency of staff. And consistency in staff drives quality of care. We need a stable workforce, and an increase would help. 97% of our funding comes from government. In other words, we have no way to cost shift or raise the price of our burgers. Even the minimum wage will impact people who will be paid to sleep at night, and as you increase their wages, you take it away from other folks because the money is so limited. 79% of all of the money that we get goes to caregiver wages and compensation. 6 over the last 5 years. Inflation, difference between inflation and wages has been 10%. I'll cut to the chase. I have a few more facts, but the point is, without additional revenue, very likely these caregivers who haven't seen increases for 4 years will see another one. With an increase, we can possibly have a wage increase for the caregivers who serve our most vulnerable people across the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And again, folks want to testify, just kind of a pro chair and a concern chair. We're finding all of you on the list as you speak. We've been able to locate everyone. So please, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. You do have a handout for me that's titled Reaction to Governor's Tax Proposal. I appear today in support of the general tenor of the governor's proposal. We support the fact that the governor's tax proposal, budget proposal, does provide for a balanced budget in both this year and this biennium and the coming year without resorting to one-time devices such as accounting shifts or securitizing future revenue sources. We also welcome the emphasis on property tax relief and welcome the additional $40 million that the governor is proposing for program aid. We do, however, have a significant concern with the design of the property tax rebate program, the program that basically gives average homeowners who live in $61,000 homes or less a get-out-of-paying-tax card. Free is not appropriate in our minds without regards to the individual's income or means. We think that the program has to be more targeted. As you know, this governor's proposal does expand the sales tax, and we support the general concept that if a good for a do-it-selfer is taxable, such as a hair clipper, then the service for an individual who desires to get that from another individual should be taxable as well, such as a haircut. But we do have concerns that is basically with the business-to-government and government-to-government services. We would like to work with the administration and with you to address our concerns in that regard. That I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Myra, I understand you're going to read someone's testimony.
Yes.
Who couldn't come back.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading this on behalf of John Foss. I would like to apologize for my absence. I wish I could deliver this important message in person. I am a lifelong Minnesotan who built the Foss Swim School, starting with just 12 students in an apartment pool 20 years ago. We have been successful because we love children and endeavor to be absolute experts in the field of swimming. We have taught 10 million lessons to over 100,000 Minnesota children. I have spoken as an expert all over the world. Everyone can learn to swim well, no matter your race. Families struggle to afford our lessons. We endeavor to keep our prices as low as possible. We strongly oppose Governor Dayton's tax proposal and consider it both terrible and tragic. Drowning is the leading cause of death for children under 5. In 2011, 41 people drowned or were permanently disabled by drowning in Hennepin County alone. Anything necessary for children should never be taxed. The combination of the four newly proposed taxes will put an additional $1 million burden on the families using the FOSS program in 2014. Minnesota would be the only state with this tax. We know of no country in the world that has this tax. When Governor Dayton penned this tax proposal, he felt by being bringing more dollars to St. Paul, he could do more good. But as my father, who was a surgeon and chief of staff at Bethesda Hospital, told me, the road to hell is lined with good intentions. On behalf of the 3,000 pools and organizations that teach swimming in Minnesota, find the courage to say no. Respectfully submitted, John Foss, owner of Foss Swim Schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Myra, and please let Mr. Foss know. You did a beautiful job for him, so thank you. Please, others. And again, I want to mention that many of the folks submitted written testimony and have decided not to reappear on Friday. So, Ms. Nauman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, formerly known as the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. We represent cities in the 7-county metropolitan region before both the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. I want to speak to a couple of aspects of the governor's bill. First of all, we appreciate the increase in the LGA, the local government appropriation of $80 million that is in the governor's budget, which follows a decade in which many cities have seen very significant reductions to local government aid with significant impacts on city budgets and services. Metro Cities also appreciates the key concepts behind the governor's LGA formula changes, which aim to add stability to the distribution of LGA and to better meet the needs of those cities in the metropolitan area that are not well served under the current LGA structure. Cities in the metropolitan region, including the core cities and many older suburbs, have seen very disproportionate and severe reductions to their local government aid in the last decade, with the result that aid to metropolitan area cities overall has now been reduced by about 50%. These cities are often characterized by aging infrastructure, changing demographics, relatively low tax capacities, and high service needs. So we're very appreciative of the intentions behind the governor's proposal in that respect. These changes over time have resulted in an LGA program in which the split of LGA is now 70% to Greater Minnesota and 30% to the metropolitan area. Again, we commend the governor for recognizing the needs of the core cities and the older ring suburbs in his legislative LGA proposal. We are continuing to work to analyze the impacts of the governor's LGA proposal and want to continue working with the governor's administration and the legislature on these issues. We understand that program changes are complex and challenging, and our goal is to have a functioning LGA program that is equitable and that better accounts for metro area needs. I also want to briefly speak to concern for the business-to-business, the government-to-government proposal around sales taxes. And we do support actually reinstating the exemption for local governments around the sales tax, and we will continue to work with the governor and the legislature on these issues. Thank you for your time, Madam
Chair. Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Those with concerns. Otherwise, I think we're, Mr. Thorson, are you joining us, or is Mr. Ines going to jump up and balance it out? Please, yes, please.
Yes.
Two on the concern side, is that okay, Madam
Chair? Yeah, I think we're kind of down to just a few here. We're going every other here is how we're doing it. So please, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. MIFC members provide financial security for all stages of a consumer's life through the sale of life, disability, long-term care insurance, and annuities. MIFC members are also mutual fund providers and managers of pensions, retirement accounts, and 401ks. And our members have about 65,000 jobs here in Minnesota. We are very concerned about the expansion of the sales tax to banking and investment services provided to consumers. 62% of Minnesotans are at risk for outliving their savings. The state has a vested interest in encouraging them to save. And in fact, this fall, the Dayton administration announced an educational campaign called Own Your Future, which is designed to encourage older Americans to take responsibility for their long-term planning and retirement needs because the state may not be able to care for them. And as part of that campaign, the website urges people, among many things, to seek advice from a financial planner. The governor's tax proposal, however, proposes to tax that advice, servicing the retirement vehicles themselves, and perhaps, at least the way we read the bill, perhaps even the financial products themselves. So we are very concerned that the governor's tax proposal will actually be a disincentive for people to take responsibility for their own retirement needs. And perhaps contrary to the popular opinion, investment services are primarily used by the middle class. The average investor earns less than $100,000 per year, and the average investment in a retirement account is between $11,000 and $13,000. So we're talking about middle-class Americans that will be impacted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. We appreciate it. I think we're going to have someone take your seat, Ms. Rowan, and jump in, and then we're going to go back to former Commissioner Ines. Sorry, Mr. Ines. Someone with Mr. Thorson, you want to join us? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5. I appreciate an opportunity to speak with you
in support of the governor's budget on the tax provisions and the spending portions of the budget as well. Council 5, again, supports the, both the revenue and spending portions of the budget because we believe that after a decade of cuts, it provides a better way forward for the state. And last week, in room 5 of this building, when the Legislative Commission on Fiscal and Policy, LCPFP, I forget the acronym, put together a list of how budget solutions have been dealt with since 2003. And we have gone again and again to the bank of shifts, reserves, securitizing, future revenue, down near everything but asking for additional revenue for the budget solution. And but for the health impact fee back in 2003, we think it's time to put balance back into the equation, and that provides a better way forward for the state. Particularly in local government aid and county program aid, we support the governor's addition of resources to help local units of government provide services that are necessary because the cost of the cuts during this last decade has been very costly for residents that require these services. And I spoke with Deed on Wednesday, and according to the CES, the current employment statistics, seasonally adjusted, there are 12,300 fewer local government positions in the state today than there were prior to the Great Recession. And that's 12,300 individuals that aren't providing services to our communities throughout the state. A lot of these services they provide are counter-cyclical to the business cycle and are necessary for folks, and we think the time to invest and support these services begins with the revenue in this budget. We'd appreciate your consideration of the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Tharson. Mr. Innes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Innes. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, and I want to articulate our strong opposition to the sales tax on financial services. If Minnesota was to adopt that tax, we'd be one of only four states in the country that have a sales tax on financial services. And based on our reading on the bill, we believe it would be the broadest tax of that sort in the nation. And I think the larger point I'd like to make is no state of any significance, and no offense to New Mexico, South Dakota, and Hawaii, but no state of any significance has successfully imposed a large, broad-based sales tax on services. And I think you have two examples in the last 30 years that tried unsuccessfully to impose such a tax, Florida and Michigan. I think Michigan is probably the most analogous. In 1986, they actually passed legislation that broadly expanded the sales tax to many professional services. They spent over a year analyzing the tax before it went into effect. They had two commissions, one done by the Department of Revenue, another one done by the most preeminent tax experts in the entire country. People like Walter Hellerstein came together to try to iron out all the issues about, you know, sourcing the transactions, administering the tax, taxpayer compliance and education. And they went live in July of 1987, and the tax was repealed in December of the same year. So basically 6 months after the tax was enacted, after a lot of due diligence, a lot of thought went into the imposing this tax, it was repealed within 6 months. The Michigan example is analogous. It was actually repealed before, within 24 hours of its effective date due to all the problems associated with the tax. I think it's one of those times where the theory sounds great. I think we all understand we're more of a service-oriented economy. We need to move to a more service-oriented sales tax. The reality is, though, when the theory comes up against the hard realities of actually imposing and administrating the tax, the theory does not hold up. And those are my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Innes. Others, please, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Committee. Thank you for hearing my testimony. My name is Colin Kiriton, and I'm a graduate student in applied economics at the University of Minnesota, and I'm in support of the revenue in Governor Dayton's proposal. While I'm here to talk economics, rest assured that I'm more than just a pie-in-the-sky student. I've also run community programs in the Twin Cities for 5 years in schools, churches, parks, and libraries, and I've seen our state grow poorer. I have a sister who works full-time and goes to school full-time. She regularly wrestles with whether the high cost and little sleep is worth it, and I don't blame her. I also have a brother who started a successful life but lost his job in the Great Recession, has since struggled greatly, even experiencing bouts of homelessness. He still has trouble accessing basic services he needs to get back on track. The story of my family is a perfect example of the primary opportunity cost of making decisions in the interests of the wealthy few as opposed to meeting the needs of working and middle-class people. That opportunity cost is quite literally the struggle and unharnessed potential of an entire generation. I think it's hard for other generations to understand my generation's frustration that they are so willing to invest in us the way FDR and LBJ invested in them. Second, I'd like to challenge the implicit economic assumptions that drive most of this public debate. So the argument goes, the mere mention of modest revenue increases will send the wealthy running and they'll take all the jobs with them. Aside from the dubious empirical evidence that modest and temporary increases in taxes on the wealthy grind economic growth to a halt, I'd also like to present an alternate and, I believe, more accurate frame. To put it simply, the targets in General Mills in Minnesota are assets that contribute to our community and employ many people, but Target will not create the next Target, and General Mills will not create the next General Mills. Innovation, economic growth, and a prosperous society are the result of broad-based investments in human capital. Those investments help my sister get through school, and they help get my brother back in the job market. They give the tools necessary for bright young people to create the next Google or Medtronic. Relating to our shameful disparities, I would posit that upwards of 20 or 30 or even 40% of subsegments of our state are a much greater economic threat than are the threat of the wealthy few leaving. So my time is up, but I'd like you to support the governor's revenue plan and invest in a Minnesota that will work for its state's young people. Thank you
so much for your testimony. We appreciate you being here. Thank others. I think we're getting down to it here. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Levin. I'm the state director of the Sierra Club North Star Chapter. We're a grassroots organization working to protect Minnesota's environment with over 30,000 members and supporters across the state. Thanks for the opportunity today. The Sierra Club supports the proposed budget and the prioritization of a transit system that will support economic growth in the Twin Cities and across the state. The new sales tax revenue will address funding shortfalls for current commitments to bus and rail and expand the regional bus system to help students, seniors, people with disabilities, and other Minnesotans get to where they need to go. Building out our transit system is an excellent return on investment. It will create thousands of jobs, improve our air quality, and reduce carbon emissions that contribute to climate change. New revenue for transit in the budget sends a clear signal that transit will help drive our economy and reduce our dependence on costly oil. As a member of the Transit for a Stronger Economy Coalition, we join the governor and the 91% of citizens across the state who all agree that public transportation is a good investment for Minnesota. The governor's budget also includes an urgently needed restoration of funding to the Department of Natural Resources and the Pollution Control Agency, reversing years of declines in funding for our environmental agencies as a percentage of state appropriations. These are the agencies we depend on to safeguard Minnesota's precious natural resources, our air, water, lands, and wildlife that are so crucial to our way of life and to protect the health of our families and our communities. Environmental laws require effective monitoring and enforcement to work properly. The overwhelming public turnout at the recent Environmental Congress listening session shows that our citizens expect more from the state when it comes to protecting our environment. Adequate funding will allow our agencies to work better together and to work more effectively and efficiently for Minnesotans.
Thank you, Ms. Levin. We appreciate you being here. Others? I think there are no others. Is anyone making their way? Everyone, we appreciate everyone's attention and all the work that's gone into this, and we are going to adjourn unless there's someone else. We are adjourning. Members, we are adjourned.